The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. Please do subscribe, give us a review. All of that stuff helps for us to reach a bigger audience. So thank you as always. On this week's episode, we'll be speaking to Dr. Eric Benbow, who's studying something called the necrobiome. And he's arguing that we don't leave dead bodies around anymore. And that's probably not good for the ecosystem, not human bodies, of course. The carcasses of animals are much fewer nowadays for a number of different reasons. And he's wondering whether or not that is having effect on the flora and fauna of our habitats. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. If you'd like to comment, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us. We're at Newstalk Science. We get to those at the end of the podcast. But here to reflect on the week's happenings are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and museum specialist Dr. Catherine McGuinness. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with this upcoming climate conference, which seems to be the big one. And already we're seeing that some people are saying one thing and doing another.
Absolutely. So this is a gathering of all governments in the world, virtually every one of them, and they're looking to form consensus around what we can do to tackle climate change. This follows a series of reports from the International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Most recently, we noted that they said this is code red for humanity. And this meeting is to try and figure out what we can do. And as with any political summit, there has been a significant amount of lobbying going on from people who have interests. And we've seen in just this week that there's been a leak showing that certain countries are really lobbying to play down the seriousness of climate change. And they're suggesting that the move away from carbon could be slower than what scientists are saying we need to do. So of the 32,000 submissions made to the scientists, most of them are positive and very constructive. Some from countries like Japan, Australia, Saudi Arabia, and Norway are not so positive. You might say they're a little bit, you know, in their own interests. And that's fine. That's how politics works. But I think it's really important for us all to know about that and for us to be aware of why they might be saying those things and to take what they're saying kind of, you know, and accept it at face value, but see it for what it is, which is vested interest looking out for their own corner. And that not be in the best interest of everyone else. And so if we are to trust the science and if we are to trust the agreement that comes from it, I think we need to be transparent. We need to be basing our decisions on expertise. But crucially, and this is often overlooked, we need to look at the benevolence of the actors within. So like, who's saying what and for what reason? So, you know, if you're saying it because you're trying to defend the interests of your country or your shareholders or whoever, that's fine. You're entitled to do it. But it doesn't mean that that view gets to dominate against the greater good, which often has a very silent voice in these sorts of meetings.
Yeah, I mean, this obviously leak happened a good few days ago, but I wanted to chat with you about it because I wanted to ask you, do you think this betrays a greater story that we're not getting from leaks? One of the things that stands to mind is Volkswagen's, among other car manufacturers, but Volkswagen's rigging of the diesel emissions, which horrified me, that they were presenting that their cars were cleaner than they were. That to me is an absolutely damning thing to do, but they got caught. And in this case, Japan, Australia, Saudi Arabia, they got caught. What really worries me is this is the most pressing issue in the history of humanity. And I feel that this sort of stuff is probably happening all the time, where vested interests are stopping us from getting to where we need to be to save the planet, literally. That sounds very dramatic, but literally.
No, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, was there ever a time when there was a greater need for strong public institutions where we can trust the people who are operating within them? And there has been stories like Naomi Oreskes has a fantastic book about how the various lobbying groups in the US employed scientists just to cast doubt about the research that was coming out in the 60s about tobacco, and how that led to a 20 or 30 year delay in meaningful change. And we can't afford that kind of stuff when it comes to climate change. We really can't, you know. I know that change is hard, and I know that it's going to come at a cost. But like, what option do we have?
For me, what is worrying is the fact that since the Volkswagen scandal, and there were other car manufacturers, but Volkswagen being such an enormous brand, was caught red-handed. What really terrifies me is that has completely gone away now. The figures from Volkswagen didn't seem to be affected at all.
No.
And people are still buying Volkswagen cars despite having heard this news. And it really terrifies me that despite these sort of things happening, we don't vote with our feet. We don't buy with our conscience. And that is on us.
And it really comes down to these big actors. That's where change will really be seen. Because we saw in the newspapers this week that when at the worst of the pandemic, the cuts in our emissions in Ireland was 3.6%, which is nowhere near what it needs to be. And that's with basically everyone staying at home. So it just shows you that the majority of our emissions are not going to be solved by individual action, but instead by us asking those big actors, governments, huge companies, for them to lead the change, because that's where we see the significant changes.
Our second story is quite alarming in a way, Catherine, and it has to do with embryos used for implantation, which anyone who's gone through the IVF process or knows someone who's gone through IVF knows how emotional and how devastating it is to find that these embryos are not viable. Tell me about this study.
Yeah, it is quite alarming. And I suppose before we start, we should say that this might be a triggering conversation for some listeners. And so if you are affected, take care of yourself. This was reported in The New Scientist, and they were looking at studies based in the US. And when you go through IVF, you have an egg and a sperm taken from donors, and they're mixed together. And in the US, they perform what are called pre-implantation genetic screening, or PGS. And what this does is it looks for any chromosomal abnormalities that might be in the embryo. And if this is found, these are referred to as mosaic embryos. And really what happens with these mosaic embryos is that sometimes they're discarded, or sometimes they're overlooked for embryos from the same cycle that don't display any of these chromosomal abnormalities. Now, studies in the US followed the use of mosaic embryos in IVF. And what has turned up really is that they tend to have any embryos that are considered having a low level or a moderate level of mosaicism have as good a chance as making the first trimester to the end of the first trimester, and as good having as good a chance to make it to birth. And with the children showing no abnormalities and showing no kind of health risks. So it throws up a big question about the whole identification of these mosaic embryos. How are they tested? And, you know, is this something happening during embryonic development in the womb that we don't know what's happening? So they don't know whether it's that as these mosaic embryos develop, that they just get rid of the chromosomal abnormalities. And if that happens, we don't know why or how. Or is it just that, and what they think is more likely, is that it's the testing techniques that are used that are not accurate enough. And then some of these embryos that are being classed as mosaic are actually not.
How common is this mosaicness?
So they reckon 1 in 4 embryos are found to be mosaic in IVF. And I will say this is a US study. So 1 in 4. Now, what will happen is these mosaic embryos will be frozen and be used more as a kind of last chance embryo. And you would always, if you've gone through IVF, you know, you always will use the most viable embryo first and then make your way through whatever store you have.
So these embryos, if pregnancy doesn't result in healthier embryos, these embryos are used then? I didn't realize that.
They can be used. And it really is good. So you've got to remember with IVF, it differs from clinic to clinic. So, you know, it's not always the same but sometimes they are discarded or not used at all.
Right. And I suppose if you can only afford a certain number of rounds of IVF, you know, people might not think that those embryos were viable and decide, you know, it's probably not worth the chance. So really, really interesting. Does this change, do you think, healthcare for upcoming IVF treatment, or will it trickle down to how IVF is practiced?
I think definitely there's going to be a closer look at the testing, because the testing is a very, very delicate, very, very difficult thing to do. What they do is they take some cells from a 5-day old embryo, which you can imagine just the technology needed just to do that. And then these cells are tested for this mosaicism. Now, these cells don't go towards making up the child or the baby later on in pregnancy. These are the cells that will go towards making the placenta. So there is that argument that really the testing is not up to scratch.
Shane, our third story is another medical one, and a remarkable study in which a kidney from a pig was transplanted to the leg of a brain dead patient.
Yeah, this is remarkable work from NYU, so that's New York University. The first pig to human kidney transplant, a xenotransplant. And as you said, the patient in question here had no detectable brain activity, and their family gave consent for this groundbreaking operation to be completed. Now, while this work is not peer reviewed, it is, I suppose it's just too soon. It has only happened in the last few days, but remarkably after 54 hours of the kidney being inserted into the human, the pig kidney into the human, there is no sign of rejection. Why is that possible? Well, like if you were to put any organ into a human that wasn't their own, and particularly if it's from a different species, the body is going to reject it. And that's a good thing, right? Because it keeps us alive. But when it comes to doing something extraordinary like this, you need to dampen down the body's capacity to reject the alien organ. And so what they've done here is they've used a particular type of pig, and it's called a Galsaf pig. And it's called that because it has been genetically modified. So it lacks the gene that contributes to the production of something called alpha-gal, which is a carbohydrate that triggers the reaction for rejection. And so the result of this is that you can now take a kidney from a genetically modified pig and put it into a human, and at least up to 54 hours, the human is not going to reject it. This is a whole new world, right? But it has complications.
Well, I mean, certainly, this is a sort of a proof of concept idea. It wasn't actually implanted to where the kidney goes, and it was just the idea of whether or not the kidney would continue to, in inverted commas, stay alive. It's attached to blood vessels, and it as you say, that immune response did not kick in. But this is a single case. There's so much more to go. But I remember starting this program 10 years ago, and we were talking about the future of transplantation, not having a waiting list. And one day, the idea of being able to transplant a pig's heart, a liver, and so on, because they are relatively similar in size to human beings, as being, you know, the holy grail. So exciting about this. But as you say, there are complications. There are things that mean we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, and a lot of them are ethical. And it's not to say that that's going to be a showstopper and just say, right, no more of it. But we just have to be mindful about animal welfare and about how we treat these things. And where's the line with these sorts of things? You know, are we going to start sort of, you know, it is literally, quite literally, harvesting organs. And what's our boundaries there? How do we regulate it? But that's not to say that this could be a potentially game-changing procedure for people who have chronic kidney issues, or indeed issues with other organs. And as we know, the waiting list for organ transplant in Ireland and in most other countries is years. So many people die because they don't get their organ transplant in time.
Catherine, as someone who... this is your world, animals, working with dead animals as well, who I'm sure you've seen lots of insides yourself. How do you feel about it? Because I mean, when you say it's harvesting organs, I say, yes, that is technically true. At the same time, we use animals for food, for clothing, for research. This would be one of the most benign uses of animals if we can manage to save human lives. But there is that question that hangs above it. What are your thoughts?
To be honest with you, now I know people would have different views against it, for it, and in my opinion, I mean, if we can improve and better our situation, if we can find ways of making people's lives better, find cures, I think there's nothing wrong with doing something like this. I know, coming from, you know, and I'm a background, I'm very well aware of people of animal rights, animal protection. But as you say yourself, this is a very benign use. And I think that the benefits really outweigh any concerns.
Not for the pigs, it isn't, I suppose, as some people might say. Let us know your thoughts. You can text us 53106 for 30 cent. You know, harvesting of pig organs for human use as transplantation to save human lives. Is that something that you are okay with morally and ethically? You can also tweet us. We're at Newstalk Science, or email science@newstalk.com. Catherine, our final story is one that popped up during the week, which I thought was fascinating. It had to do with Vikings.
Yes. So, yeah, 1492, Columbus wasn't the first person to claim America, basically, is the upshot of this. So we've known in folklore, we've had stories about different Europeans who traveled across the Atlantic before Columbus and made it there before him. One of these guys is a Viking called Leif the Lucky, Leif Erikson, and he comes from Norse folklore in Iceland, the Icelandic sagas. And it was believed that he created a settlement in North America called Vinland. And then in 1960, archaeologists uncovered the site at Lands o' Meadows in Newfoundland in Canada. And looking at the buildings and the artifacts found there, and also using carbon dating, we at the time thought the site was roughly around 990 AD to maybe 1050 AD. So a good 450 years before Columbus. But back in 1960, carbon dating techniques weren't really as good and as accurate as we have today. Now, carbon dating, basically what that is we're looking at the radioactive isotope of carbon that is found in the atmosphere. It's absorbed by living things, including trees and their bark. So a new marker along the radiocarbon timeline was a solar storm that happened in 993 AD. And this caused a really high level of radiocarbon in the atmosphere. And this was absorbed by trees. Now, Viking buildings, if you know anything about Vikings, are timber-built structures. So the archaeologists from the University of Groningen looked at the timber and the logs from these buildings, and they were able to find, using dendrochronology, looking at the rings of the logs, they found this marker, this 993 AD marker, in the logs. And then simple dendrochronology, they counted the rings out from that ring, and this site is dated quite accurately to 1021 AD. So literally 1,000 years ago this year. So now we have actual proof, scientific proof, that Europeans were in North America before Columbus.
That's really, really cool, isn't it? And I suppose it's a fact not very widely known. What an extraordinary achievement back then.
Yeah, oh God, absolutely. I mean, you know, from our own folklore, we have Brendan the Navigator, whose journey happened another 500 years before Leif the Lucky. But we have no proof at all that he made it to North America. Some of the descriptions from his journey do tie in with the Icelandic headland and the Icelandic geographics. But this is our first real scientific proof where we can say, yes, absolutely, these guys were there in 1021 AD.
Well, Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and museum specialist Dr. Catherine McGuinness, thanks so much for joining us. Now, when we hike through the forests, fields and mountains of Ireland, though they may sometimes seem like landscapes that have remained unchanged for centuries, for many reasons, that's not true. For one thing, there's a lot fewer corpses lying around. Our next guest says that's not necessarily a good thing. He's Dr. Eric Benbow, a forensic entomologist and microbial ecologist from the Department of Entomology at Michigan State. He joins me now. Eric, welcome to the program. This is a term that I hadn't heard of before, the necrobiome. Can you explain to me what is a necrobiome and why is it so important?
So the necrobiome is the consortium of organisms that are associated with and use decomposing carcasses. And that can come in the form of the microbes that were in the once living organism, and then the microbes that come in on flies that are attracted to a carcass, for instance. Or it can be the vertebrate scavengers, like foxes that will come in sometimes, or the birds, the corvid birds that will come in. But it also includes the consortium of organisms or the community of species that can be impacted by the decomposing carcass. So for instance, you have a decomposing deer, for instance, that the microbes will be affected in the soil communities, and the microarthropods will have a response. And then the vegetation that recolonizes that area will change because of the decomposition process and the changes of the community. So it's all the organisms that contribute to the decomposition of a carcass, but also the organisms that are directly impacted by that decomposition process.
We often talk about, you know, ecosystems and the circle of life, and how the death of one animal is the beginning of another, and same with plants. How important is the necrobiome, the carcasses of animals, to the health of an ecosystem?
So sometimes there's quick examples of it. For instance, a fish kill or a mass mortality event of a fish in a small pond. Those don't decompose as quickly as we would like sometimes. And so if you could think about, if there wasn't a really efficient ecological mechanism to recycle dead things, dead organic matter, it would simply start to pile up. If it starts to pile up, then everything that has consumed other nutrients and other energy from ecosystems will ultimately deplete those sources. So the necrobiome is each of those species have been highly evolved to detect something that just died and then start competing for those free resources, for that free carbon, that free energy that is now once again available. So they recycle the nutrients and energy in ecosystems in a way that we don't fully understand and certainly hasn't been appreciated in a lot of the scientific literature until the last decade or so.
So this isn't an old study. This is something that's only recently interesting scientists and ecologists?
I think there's been a lot of interest in understanding how something dies. Maybe that's because of pathogens that are associated with a carcass sometimes, or carcasses that contaminate water supplies and then make people ill. So there's been interest in death, for sure, the decomposition in some ways, but often not within a scientific framework. Some of the 18th century work in Europe, there were folks that were looking at insects that would colonize a human body. And namely, that was a kind of a creative way to try to figure out a forensic case, a homicide during that time. And in also early, I think, 12th century or 13th century in China, they used blowflies, which are naturally attracted to something dead and blood, to identify someone who had murdered another person in the area. And so I think anecdotally and in applications like forensics, there has been interest. And indeed, that was the case in the last 30 years. There's been a surge of people that are interested in insects and now microbes for forensic purposes. But what we have often neglected, I think, and you can see it in the literature, or I guess I should say you can't really see it in the literature. You don't find a lot of carrion ecology or decomposition studies just to understand the natural importance of it. I have my own hypotheses for why that is, but some of it is a lot of the scientific interest was associated with understanding plant decomposing organic matter and how important that biomass and that energy and nutrients are to ecosystems.
Right.
We've certainly neglected carrion, and that's interesting.
Has there been a big change, do you think, in the level of carcasses lying around? I mean, you still see, I suppose, roadkill, but it's very rare you'd find a dead cow or a dead goat on, you know, on a mountain path or so on. Do we think there used to be a lot more carrion on the land and feeding that ecosystem?
Yeah, so certainly naturally produced carrion, meaning just part of the living and life cycle of many different organisms. Carrion can come in the form of like a mass emergence of cicada. You have lots and lots of carcasses, thousands, millions of carcasses that are deposited on the landscape. But also, if you think more, and this is more visual for a lot of people, a dead deer, like a roe deer, red deer, you typically don't see it in the ecosystem. But what we have been able to do is start to make estimates of how those naturally occurring carcasses have lowered. We think their abundance in the landscape is lowered, and that has to do with climate change, for instance, warmer winters. There's more survivors through the winter. Winter often is a bottleneck for those that are more susceptible to dying in a lot of those ungulate populations. And so there's also feeding stations oftentimes. You know, so people think they're doing a great thing to feed the deer in their backyard. That's great, but in a normally harsh winter when, let's say, 10% would die, perhaps they've saved a certain number of those. And so encroaching landscape as well has reduced the population numbers of naturally occurring ungulates and predators and mesopredators of those. And those themselves, the predators themselves, ultimately provide carcasses to the landscape. And so when you get huge anthropological impacts, whether that's through landscape modification or climate modification, we are reducing the biodiversity on Earth. And I think there's a lot of literature to support that. But also we're reducing the densities of those just by naturally taking up their space.
And I suppose in natural parks, we're probably removing those carcasses when they're seen because there's a public distaste to seeing dead animals, right?
Yeah. There's been reductions to sanitize natural forested ecosystems, but also to remove top predators. Top predators actually provide a substantial component of carrion biomass into ecosystems because they naturally take down a large ungulate, they eat 70% of it, or maybe less sometimes, and they leave the rest there. That's important energy and nutrients for the ecosystems. And so both removing the carcasses, but also modifying the ecosystems in a way that reduces the number of available carcasses is leading to this overall change in that important source of energy and nutrients to ecosystems.
So there is some work trying to understand this process a bit better and how important carrion is to the life cycle of these ecosystems. Tell me what's going on in Germany.
So the collaborators in Germany in the National Bavarian National Parks there, so they're running several different experiments. And some of those experiments are placing carcasses in random locations. And then in other ways, they'll put the carcasses in one feeding location, so multiple carcasses in the same location. And they're evaluating how does that affect the scavengers that are attracted and use those carcasses. And they're looking at both terrestrial vertebrates and avian scavengers, finding that a lot of endangered species, or at least some of the endangered species in Central Europe, are affected by the carcass placement. And some of the more rare birds, scavenging birds that come in are also affected by one, where the carcasses are placed, but also how often and the frequency of them. And then they've also placed carcasses along elevational gradients and under different land use characteristics. And they're monitoring how that affects the invertebrate, okay, and the insect colonization and use of these carcasses. And what they're finding is that elevation surprisingly does have an important impact on the scavengers that will come in. Some of the more shy scavengers like lynx, for instance, aren't often found where carcasses are placed near more domestic settings or more suburban settings. And so where you place the carcasses seems to be important on what scavengers you attract and how that has an effect on biodiversity, but also not as charismatic, but a lot of the insects that use and really are can be have substantial impacts on the decomposition and recycling of these. The insects are also affected by landscape encroachment and the ability to get to a carcass sometimes.
Is it dangerous to sort of as we, you know, in the same way as people are feeding deer in the backyard and affecting the balance of predator versus prey, Isn't it the same worry that if we're putting out carrion that's, you know, that hasn't died naturally, that it might not give us a proper understanding of what's going on?
I think that's a fair question. You know, to place carcasses in the same location over and over, you know, is that too artificial to really understand? But I think when you start to look at the complexities of managing natural resources, you have to start somewhere. And so what the science that they're doing in Germany is really at that point. It's when, if we're going to provision carcasses, what's the best way to do it? And what are the consequences, both positive and negative? And so I think we need to start there, because you have to think about practical considerations. You know, how often do you have to pull in a mule deer to a remote location to have a beneficial impact on the overall ecosystem? If you can do the same thing by putting the mule deer 20 meters into the forest or 50 meters in the forest instead of 2 kilometers. So those are the types of questions that they're very interested in and I think need to be answered.
How do the public feel about this sort of experiment? You know, I believe it's not just in one place, but in various public parks, the idea is to let carrion stay until it's fully decomposed. And also, as you say, in some parks actually put it there on purpose. How does the public react to something like that?
To be honest, I haven't interacted much with the public in that capacity. I have through hearsay. They find it very distasteful, right? I think everyone's naturally repulsed by death and decomposition. The olfactory senses light up, right? And there's a reason for that, because carcasses, especially human carcasses, as we've evolved, if they were left nearby, they would ultimately contaminate water sources or food sources, and people would get sick and be associated with that. And so there's a natural aversion to just want to sanitize and get the carcasses away as soon as possible. But I think as we better understand how quickly carrion can be recycled, and if we start to recognize that maybe that's why we as scientists haven't studied it, is one, we're naturally repulsed, but two, it's so efficiently recycled, you don't see it out there. And so the public doesn't see it then either. And it can be recycled quite quickly. And so the public needs to understand that. It doesn't have to be a bad thing, and there might be good ways to manage it so that the public doesn't have to see it.
Why is it that fresh carcass is nutritious and good for the ecosystem and for those who devour it, and decomposed flesh is very much not useful? Why would a corpse, for example, poison water? What's happening there that makes it suddenly toxic?
You're loaded with bacteria. Each and every one of us, all of the vertebrate organisms that are out there, all the invertebrates, we share a huge amount of our biomass with microbial biomass. And a lot of those are bacteria. And if you think about the extent of your gastrointestinal tract, right? I can't remember how many meters the small and large intestine are, but they're filled with bacteria. And a lot of those are enteric bacteria that are natural pathogens to us if they become too abundant in us. And if we eat those in a high enough number. And so when something dies, you can eat the flesh, or a lot of organisms can eat a lot of the flesh and it's very nutritious, but the microbes are constantly changing. They go through a sequence of community change that we call succession. And more certain organisms of that succession become more abundant, some become less abundant. And often with decomposition and later decomposition, it's a microbial or bacterial pool, cesspool of fluids that do harbor pathogens of humans and can harbor pathogens of wildlife as well. And so the natural process, we think, if you allow it to happen, the insects and then the soil communities begin to take those organisms up, and they change the community in a way that is overall beneficial to the ecosystem. You just have to stay away from it.
I know that there are body farms in the States, and I think Europe recently opened its first body farm in which humans were left for scientific reasons decomposing in various arenas. I know for forensic scientists, they would use corpses that had been donated for science and put them in all manner of environments to see how they decompose, to help police understand how long a body's been there and how it may have died or what may have been the environment in which it was, whether or not it was moved and so on. Is that happening in Europe? Have you come across this work? And what do you think that teaches us about the necrobiome? Do those human bodies have the same effect as the carrion of wild animals?
So actually, I have been involved with a group, a multidisciplinary collaborative group that's working in that anthropological facility in Amsterdam, I believe, or the Netherlands, somewhere in the Netherlands. In that particular facility, they're required to bury the cadavers to a certain extent. And that's
when you say to a certain extent, and I know, like, do you mean half bury them or?
I believe they have to.
like, are they coming out of the ground?
Well, so the papers that I've worked with them on, and I've studied the microbes of those processes, it sounds as if they have to bury them within a few centimeters underneath the surface of sand, more of a sand loamy substrate. Instead of, if you think about a true burial of, 2 meters down. So they bury them a little bit, and meaning a few centimeters. So that's a little bit, it changes the way the body's going to decompose. Now, if you have a shallow burial as part of a death investigation, incredibly important to understand how that process is going and how it's different from bodies that are laid on top of the surface of the soil. Yeah. And there are differences. There is incredible utility in understanding both. We do know that using insects to estimate a post-mortem colonization interval, meaning when do the insects colonize, that's often within minutes of death, within minutes of a post-mortem interval.
Wow.
We're using microbes to do the same thing at better resolution. We can determine within hours sometimes. And then there are groups that are doing, for instance, protein degradation of certain tissues. And so then you have a half-life of a certain protein in a certain tissue. You can estimate how long someone's been dead by the half-life of those molecules as well. And so the work that's being done there is multidisciplinary, as biochemists, entomologists, microbial ecologists, anthropologists. And we're trying to look at what's the collective metrics of decomposition that can be used in a death investigation in the future. And that happens in Australia and North America as well.
That I find that really interesting. And I suppose that succession of bacteria that you talked about, these various dynasties coming to the fore as the nature and nutrients of the body change, you can imagine that could also be used as sort of a time gauge as to when things happened, if it's fairly uniform in a carcass or corpse.
Yeah. My collaborators and I have done a lot of work, both in anthropological facilities where you put donated human cadavers out. But we've also worked with medical examiners to do it as part of normal autopsy and death investigation. Meaning we have them in a standardized way, sample the bodies immediately before autopsy. And they swab the nose, the mouth, the ears, the anus, and other areas where we have picked up really good signals from the community succession of the microbes, meaning we can predict how long that person's been dead with the microbes pretty well within a day or so. And that can become quite important to a death investigation. If someone says, I saw so-and-so alive yesterday, but our microbes say, this person was dead like 6 days ago, or plus or minus 2 days. Why are you sure about that? Why are you lying? It's interesting.
You can have one of those Columbo moments, I suppose. so should we leave carcasses on the ground, if we see dead animals, if our cat dies in the garden, is it a bad idea to leave those things around, or should we allow nature to take its course?
You know, it's a complex question, and what I would recommend with the limited data that we know in, for instance, carrion availability and decomposition in suburban areas, for instance, where most people are going to be, probably clean it up if you want to clean it up, right? If you're repulsed by it, or if you think your dogs or cats will scavenge it and bring home a mouthful, maybe clean it up. For natural parks in large expanses of natural ecosystems, the science suggests for biodiversity sake and ecosystem function sake, leave them be. It's always been like that. Before humans were here, there were always cadavers. And since humans have been here, we've probably modified the input of natural cadavers in a way that's never going to change. But to get back and have the positive, or at least the natural biodiversity, energy flow, nutrient dynamic effects, I say leave them there. In your backyard, we leave a dead possum in our backyard and we evaluate the flies that come in.
Okay, yeah, but that's because you're weird. That's yeah, exactly. To do it, so it's because you're an odd man.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so you have some suggestions. Leave it be, says Dr. Eric Benbow, forensic entomologist from Michigan State. Eric, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
If you live in a rural area or are someone who goes walking in the wild woods quite a lot, how often do you come across dead carcasses? Well, I suppose all carcasses are dead, aren't they? And if you live in a rural area and have let an animal go to seed, have you noticed anything about that area, or, you know, have flowers sprung up in the place of the dead horse? Love to hear from you. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. Now, to some of your comments from last week, we were talking about creative flow, and Jessima was talking about this story, and I was a bit skeptical about the idea of creative flow. It's such an ephemeral, sort of untouchable thing. I'm a bit skeptical of how you measure it in any way. And Jessima was saying, actually, band players and so on, people in creative flow, their brain waves start to sync up. So I suppose that's a good metric for it. But someone says, if you'd ever been in a band that improvises and writes songs and plays gigs, then you wouldn't question the validity of flow. I was in a band and I remember going to rehearsals in North Dublin. When I say I remember them, I remember them very vaguely because there was only two rehearsals and then we split for creative differences. So I'm pretty sure we didn't achieve flow, whatever that is. Another says, another was talking about the piece we had on pain from pleasure and a little bit about the neuroscience of why we experience pleasure, or why we undergo painful things and the pleasure we get from them. Someone says, is it the same if you do something like a bungee jump? I've never been so terrified in my life, but the euphoria and sense of achievement afterwards lasted for over a week. I can totally get that. I think the euphoria of having survived something exhilarating like that is pretty big. I don't know if it's the same as being in pain. And also, like, the prick in me also wants to say achievement is a bit of a strong word for, like, literally just jumping off something. Like, I don't think, am I being overly and unnecessarily dismissive there? I think, you know, climbing a mountain, running very far, you know, swimming long distances, I don't know, that seems to me like an achievement. Standing on a board and jumping off, I don't know if that maybe I'm being unnecessarily unkind, but I'm glad you got so much out of it. And someone else says, Jonathan, the Sunday morning news talk schedule reshuffle is ? Still here for another informative hour, though. Oh, good man or woman. I can't tell from the tweet. And someone else tweeted about our piece about the billion year gap in the fossil record and how the whole swathe of history, sometimes up to a whole billion years, has disappeared in the rock and we can't quite explain it. And someone had tweeted saying, that rocks, and then a roll eyes emoji. Roll eyes emoji indeed. That's it from us for this week's programme. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to producer Ed McKelvey, Simon Keane, Garrett Mulhall, JJ Clark and Steve McClune, who was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in the podcast feed on Tuesday. It's a good one. It's about how words become the words that they are. It'll be explained better in the podcast. That's on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.